Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following recording takes place at the 2011 Roots of Change Conference in Portland, Oregon, which was sponsored by the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and Men Can Stop Rape. Speakers and workshops address the primary prevention of sexual violence with a strong focus on media, entertainment, and pop culture. Themes regarding men and masculinity were woven throughout the conference proceedings. Keynote speaker Dr. Pat McGann, Men Can Stop Rape's Director of Strategy and Planning, talks about his journey with masculinity through childhood, adulthood, marriage, and his feminist transformation.
If you see somebody as less than, is it easier to harm them? Yes. Seeing women as equal, that's what feminism is about, right? Equity and equality. Sexism is just the opposite of that, right? There's a strong connection there. What this keynote is going to do is going to explore the connections between those two, but also how men come to feminism. I want to dedicate it to my father, who passed away August 25th. It was a long, hard process. He had Alzheimer's. He had bladder cancer. This is a picture of him when he was 3. He looks to me like a little Irish urchin with dirty knees and a cute smile. And the picture became particularly important to me during his last year of life because he didn't always kind of know who I was, kind of switched roles. There were a few times when he did call me dad. And this picture kind of helped me stay in touch where he was because he would kind of travel back to his earlier life. Everybody know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross? Death and Dying, model of coping with dying. And initially, when she wrote this book, it was to present the stages of grief for somebody who was going through the process of dying. Later on, it also became connected to somebody who was close to somebody who was dying. I've been going through those stages in various ways. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. I want to suggest to you that the stages are connected to what kind of a man goes through in terms of becoming a feminist. It involves a kind of dying, a kind of passing of this traditional manhood, this patriarchal masculinity. But hopefully, there's a rebirth. And you become something else, whatever it is, this new man, this pro-feminist, this whatever you want to call this rebirth. Maybe a little exaggerated, because I don't think the traditional masculine part ever quite disappears. It's problematic for any man to just say, well, that's all past me now. It doesn't work that way. I think we all know that. But there is some newness, some new birth. And does everybody know Ben Atherton Zeman? He does a presentation called Voices of Men. Came up with stages for a man going through the process of becoming friendly with feminism. You go through that denial phase. This can't be happening. He related it to sexual assault. Can't be happening to so many millions of women. And then the anger stage. All you women who are whining about violence are just feminazis and not right. Bargaining. There are studies that show that women are just as violent. Men are the real victims. Feminism is the perpetrator. And then depression. When it finally sinks in, wow, all the men who have committed this. And I'm a man, so I'm part of this. And then acceptance. Finally, how can I help? I want to suggest the McGann model, which is a little bit different from the Ben Atherton Zeman model or the Kubler-Ross model, based on my own experiences. I'm kind of combining some stages. Denial and anger I'm putting together, that goes on for a pretty long time period. Guilt and acceptance actually should be number two. I'm putting guilt and acceptance together because if you feel guilty about something, in some sense, you're accepting it in some sense, because otherwise you wouldn't feel guilty about it. Same with bargaining. If you're trying to bargain about something, you're accepting it, not in its fullest sense maybe, but there's still some level of acceptance there. Otherwise, you'd still be stuck in denial and anger. And then acceptance and private action and then public action. So what we're going to do is kind of go through periods of my life that kind of represent these different stages. My parents married in January of 1955. In 1955 was the first wave of feminism had ended. The World War II had ended. All the women who had worked during World War II were kind of returning to the home, being encouraged to return to the home. When my parents got together, my mother was studying to be an opera singer. And my father told her, it's either me or opera, but not both. And so she chose him. Was not a feminist. She had no aware of feminism. It just wasn't in the air at all. And so it was not part of my experience growing up. In that sense, it was a larger sense of denial. I was born 9 months after they got married. People were watching closely. And here I'm about the same age as my father. I'm three. 1955 was the year McDonald's was started. It was Captain Kangaroo started. Also the year that Rosa Parks sat on the back of the bus. Till about 10 or 11 years later, in 1966, NOW was formed. Especially for those 11 years or so, feminism really didn't have much of a presence in the culture overall. We moved to Lubbock, Texas when I was 11. How many people know anything about Lubbock, Texas? Not very many. It's where Texas Tech is. Home of, obviously says home of Texas Tech. Where they have many, many good coaches, Bobby Knight, Mike Leach, and others. It's about 200,000 people. I mean, it's pretty decent size, kind of a mid-sized city. It's kind of a mid-sized city that, you know, has kind of a rural quality to it, but it's not really rural itself. A lot of people go to Tech who come, you know, from small rural towns nearby in the state. It's considered to be the tail end of the Bible Belt. And there are a lot of Baptist churches. Probably, I think they have more churches. Lubbock has more churches per capita than any other city, I believe. It seems like I've heard that somewhere. It seemed that way to me. And I was raised as a Catholic in Lubbock, so there weren't many of us there. But you're right, it's fairly conservative. And when I tell people where I'm from, a lot of the times they find it difficult to believe that I'm doing the work that I'm doing. And it's because it's so conservative. But I do feel compelled to claim, you know, Lubbock, since I lived so many years there. There's you know, I got to find something positive to claim about it. We talked about some of the things it's known for. I just want to prove to you, this is the diploma of Buddy Holly, who graduated from the Lubbock High School. And so one of the things I can claim is Buddy Holly for Lubbock, who Buddy Holly in terms of the world rock and roll doesn't get a whole lot bigger than that. And, you know, he's an anomaly, too. I mean, I don't know how in the world he ended up coming from Lubbock, although, you know, Lubbock has had its thriving music scene even after him in some ways. But certainly none of them connected to the origins of rock and roll in the way that Buddy Holly was. But it was a climate where, I grew up in a very unpolitical family. There wasn't a lot of activism. It didn't even exist. I couldn't have even explained what the word meant to you. None of my friends talked about anything to do with that. Most of the people I know voted Republican. So it was not a climate that was very friendly to the feminism. I got married. We met in college at Texas Tech. This is our wedding picture. She was not a feminist when we met, but became one shortly thereafter. And I was ill-prepared, as I've already suggested would be the case. I tried to read Erica Jong's Fear of Flying when I was in high school, if you want to consider that some kind of a feminist book, mainly because of the sex scenes. And I got 40 pages into it because I couldn't make any sense of it. There were all these psychiatrists, and I hadn't had really any experience with psychiatrists, going to a conference, and I hadn't had any experience with conferences overseas somewhere. And so I thought, I have no idea what's going on here. I'm not going to read this whole book to figure out where the sex scenes are. And so I gave up after 40 pages. And I think the only other book I had read was My Mother, Myself, which, I don't know, maybe you could consider that a feminist text, by Nancy Friday. Maybe I read that to try and understand my own mother, and I don't know whether it helped or not. But I did not have any real experience with feminism. But that doesn't mean that I didn't make proclamations about it and have opinions about it and would get really angry. And there was one memory in particular that stands out to me, and that was driving to my parents' house, who lived in Plainview at the time. They had moved there. And so we were driving from Lubbock up to Plainview, which is about 45 miles north of Lubbock. And we were arguing in a place like this, this is what a road in West Texas looks like, about feminism. And enough to where we pulled over to the side of a road like this. So we're out in the middle of nowhere arguing about feminism. And I was arguing basically that it was, you know, there's this tunnel vision to feminism. That, you know, it's about people. It's, why does this have to be about women? You know, we kept having arguments like that. And it continued to be kind of a tension in our relationship. And it became clear that I began to kind of figure out that feminism was not going away. That was clear. And so in some sense, I began to kind of accept what feminism was about, or at least my limited understanding of it without having read much or you know, studied it in very kind of way. But so I kind of slipped into this kind of guilt phase, which is, does anybody recognize the lyrics from this song? B.J. Thomas from 1975, another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song. And, you know, you get to that point where you feel like, at least in my experience, you can't do anything right. Everything you do is wrong somehow. So, and it's, you know, it's hard to live with that feeling. And at the same time, in this stage, you want, you know, I wanted Abby back the way she was when I first met her, right? It's like, oh, she was angry herself, and the anger took, you know, had taken different forms. You know, I was angry at her and feminism because it was messing up my life, and you know, she was angry at you know, men and patriarchy because it had messed up her life. We kind of went through this guilt stage for a while. Till I began to kind of work out of that. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of what that movement just there is kind of what feminism can be like for men, turn you upside down and all around. But I began to move kind of into the bargaining phase. And we left Lubbock in 1986. We were both graduate students. She was studying philosophy. I was studying English literature. And we were both looking for a college or university where we could continue with our studies. We both wanted to get PhDs. And we were excited about going to Chicago because we felt like it offered us some opportunities that Lubbock really didn't offer. I don't know if you've ever been to Chicago, but this is a famous feminist bookstore in Chicago, Women and Children First, that we actually ended up spending quite a bit of time at and quite a bit of money. So, you know, Chicago really offered us a different world in terms of progressive politics and feminism. Shortly after we moved there, the whole Iraq issue or conflict came up, and there were various protests going on. We got involved with those in various ways. And so, you know, it was a much more kind of liberal place than Lubbock had been. And as a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Chicago, I began to think about, well, maybe one of the ways I can handle this feminist thing, it was getting to a point where either, you know, I learn about feminism or we split up. It got, you know, it's getting to that point. And so I began to think about, well, you know, maybe one way to learn is, it's kind of a bargaining sort of thing. Maybe I can, you know, if I learn about it through my scholarly studies, maybe that'll work. And so, you know, I was in the language, literacy, and rhetoric program. She was in philosophy. This is our office building. It's University Hall. We're both in the same office building. It was considered a bit like a fortress. The UIC was built during the 60s, they tore down a lot of the Italian neighborhood to build UIC. So we'd go there, and you know, I started kind of beginning to work with some of the professors. And in a lot of language, literacy, and rhetoric, there are a lot more female professors than there are in philosophy. And so they were receptive to me doing work on issues connected to feminism. And in this case, particularly in, I wrote a paper called Women and the Dichotomy of Literacy, Public-Private Discourse. And it was written for a professor called Marcia Farr, who studied ethnographies of literacy and taught ethnographies of literacy. And so I was basically, it was a historical paper looking at the politics of literacy in terms of the public-private discourse and how that affected women's relationship with literacy and how men control women's experience of literacy. And I got some accolades for this. The professor loved it. I submitted it to the College Composition and Communication Conference. It got accepted there, so that was my first presentation in the field of composition and rhetoric. And then Eric, Educational Resources Information Center, requested, that's why it's still there online. I pulled this up from that. It got me some attention in this world. Abby hated it because at the same time I was getting all this attention for that, she was really struggling in philosophy. She wanted to, you know, do feminist philosophy. There was one feminist philosopher who was part of the faculty. But, you know, when she would go to other classes and try and do feminist work in philosophy, she was getting a lot of criticism and not always positive feedback. And so, you know, it didn't work out the way I had hoped it would. And, you know, it was still really a public act, right? I mean, it wasn't a personal kind of act in terms of our relationship. So I was kind of still stuck there in that public kind of... I mean, the very thing I was writing about was a problem in my personal life. So I still had to kind of figure out a way out of that. And the way that I thought that I would get past that was a little bit later on. I'd read a book called Disorderly Conduct, Visions of Gender in Victorian America, by Carol Smith Rosenberg. And in it, one of the things that she writes about is how Victorian relationships between Victorian women in the United States, or 19th century women, would have been some of the ways they communicated with each other. By our standards today, would have been considered romantic expressions. And so, you know, I'd read some of the letters that they'd written back and forth about how many kisses they would give each other, you know, if they were present, you know, and, you know, just all this sort of what seemed like very romantic expression. And I decided, well, I'll use them, I'll use this as a model. For me, because Abby was leaving, she was going back to Texas Tech for the summer to teach philosophy. And so I thought, well, and I was staying in Chicago, and I thought, I will write her a series of letters and expressing kind of how much I'm missing her and, you know, how much she means to me. And because she had complained that one of the things about our relationships was that, you know, she felt like I didn't need her, that, you know, I wasn't as affectionate as she wanted me to be. So I thought, well, I'll try doing this through writing and see if that helps. So I wrote three letters for her to take with her and open up after she got there. And then I kept writing letters every day after she left, except for a certain point. And they were really pretty good. She still has them. She's held on to them. But I couldn't keep it up. I started to kind of freak myself out. Started to seem weird, a little neurotic. I thought, this is just too much. So I couldn't maintain it. But it was a step. It was a step forward. You know, and it made it easier to do later on. So that was kind of the private action. And, you know, I kept working on that. But fifth stage, I wanted to kind of, the fifth stage really was when I realized, okay, this is not just about women. Feminism is not just about women. It's also about men, too. And it's about masculinity. Up until that point, probably, I just thought, well, you know, it's about women, and women are mistreated, sexism. You got to improve that, do things better, you know, make things right. And there's that part of it. But I think until you accept the fact that, well, feminism also has to do with me, and my life as a man, and with how I experience masculinity, until you accept that, then you really are not going to kind of get to a place where you can kind of do those public actions in a way they need to be done, I think. And for me, one of the key stages, or key parts of that stage, was the National Organization of Men Against Sexism conference in Chicago in 1992. As a grad student, I couldn't afford to go to any of the others. I'd kind of known about them for a little while because of a magazine called Changing Men that came out, I guess, late 80s and into the early mid-90s. And I founded it at Barbara's Bookstore in Oak Park, where we lived just outside of Chicago. It was also at Women and Children First. And so through it, I knew about the conferences that were held every year, and I was really curious about them and wanted to go to them. But it wasn't until 92 that I could actually go. And I volunteered, and that was the only way I could go to that, since I didn't have to pay then. And one of the things that I did when I volunteered was drive Fred Small to the airport. And pick him up from the airport and drive him to the airport. Does anybody know Fred Small? Hey, two people. All right. He's a folk singer. He does progressive music. He's actually a preacher now. He became one later on after 92. And I hadn't heard any music like his. He was singing about songs that, you know, some of them were about issues connected to masculinity and kind of the tensions that men experience between, you know, the public pressures, to prove their masculinity, and that kind of the personal, more private kind of desires to connect with people. And so I was kind of a Fred Small groupie for a day, because you know, I had all these conversations with him that about, you know, issues connected to feminism and, you know, his life on the road and various things like that. And so, you know, it was just an exciting, kind of opened a door for me. Now his music seems a little over the top to me now, but at the time it was really instrumental in having an effect on me. And you know, the conference itself was really had a strong impact. I remember at the end we formed a line around and wove around the room, kind of looking at each other as we wove around the room. And I was a little freaked out by that, too. But it still sticks with me. The image of looking at all those other men in the room was powerful. In 92, we moved to D.C., city of phallic symbols, and you know, the challenge there was to think about: are there ways I can continue to do this in D.C.? And I had no idea. We moved there because I got a job teaching at George Washington University. As a grad student, our funding had run out. We needed money, and you know, so I ended up at George Washington, and. Abby happened to look in the city paper and saw an ad for volunteers for D.C. Men Against Rape. And I thought, well, I don't know what that is, but I guess I'll check it out. And so I went to a couple meetings, and I was trying to finish my dissertation. I was feeling a little overwhelmed because we were also was teaching full time. We were trying to raise our daughter, who was 12 at that point, and we had just moved there, and things were a little crazy. And I thought, I just can't do this right now. But 5 years later, after I'd started teaching some courses on masculinity, and I asked Patrick Lemon, who's here today. And Jonathan Stillerman, who were co-directors of what was then the Men's Rape Prevention Project, if they would come and present to my classes. And they did. And after the last presentation, Patrick on the way out said, well, we're having a speaker's training, so why don't you come to that this summer? And so I did, and got involved with what at the time was the Men's Rape Prevention Project. And here you see Jonathan Zeitlin, as we called him, Jono, because there were too many Jonathans. There was an organization where there were too many people with the same names. Patrick's, Jonathan's, various David's. So we always tried to come up with ways to deal with that. And I think we were having a dance here this night. So I'd gotten involved with them. And then eventually the Men's Rape Prevention Project became Men Can Stop Rape. And I decided to leave academia and get involved with Men Can Stop Rape, and have been involved with it at this point since 97 in one form or other. I started out as a volunteer coordinator, and now I'm the director of strategy and planning. Now, for me, the question is, are there other models for bringing men into feminism? Because I don't think women, you know, getting, well, we can't organize women to get involved with men in romantic relationships and caring relationships and bring them into feminism. I don't think that's a good strategy, a long-term strategy. You know, it's, I mean, it has happened for a lot of us that way, but it's not really something that is quite as intentional as maybe we want it to be. So maybe we need a more intentional, strategic model that is going to bring men into feminism as part of prevention. So I want to suggest to you that another model, and that would be our Men of Strength Club. Here are some of the guys. These are University of Maryland football players. Actually, we've run most clubs there for a couple years now, The Most Club basically started because we got really frustrated. We were doing one-shot workshops in the schools, and we got really frustrated with those because we couldn't tell the impact we were having on men. So we decided that we had an opportunity to have a 10-session meeting with young men, and we called that the Men of Strength Club. And we began to realize that that was the kind of long-term, sustained impact that we wanted to have. So the 10 sessions grew to a year-long session. And not only grew to year-long, but the goal was then to have young men not in the club for just 1 year, but really to get them when they were freshmen and keep them all through high school in the club. So then you got veteran members who are having an impact on new members who are coming into the club. And then you would also want young men to go out and do something, you know. So it's not just about their own awareness, their own consciousness, but, you know, they're taking community action in their schools. We're doing what we call community strength projects. So, you know, once we found that when you provide young men with a space to talk about these issues, that they're hungrier to talk about them than you might think. That they have no other place to talk about it. So in terms of masculinity and all the issues that affect them, you know, they need somewhere to discuss these things. And we work through masculinity, and we start there, and then work towards issues of violence against women. We're looking at unhealthy and healthy masculinity. We're trying to promote, as I just suggested, an understanding of how those connect with sexual assault and other forms of men's violence. And then they take action, as I suggested, community strength projects. It started in D.C. It was growing to a national network. There are 100 locations in about 14 states throughout the U.S. right now. It has year-long curriculums for middle school, high school, and college students. It's not just get them in high school and keep them in for all those 4 years, but it's also get them in middle school, keep them in that, get them in high school, keep them in that. And then we've had a number of young men who, once they've gone to college, have wanted to start the club themselves and have done that, various colleges where they've been. Vital Voices called it one of the most innovative prevention programs in the United States. The other assumption is that these young men will have an impact on the school climate, that when they do these community strength projects, these young men are publicly visible men speaking out against sexual assault. Not only that, but they have many interactions with their peers in which they speak out against sexual assault. Now, when we go into a club, feminism is not kind of the word that we use, but we do talk a lot about gender equity and gender equality. I want to suggest to you that while the Men of Strength Club, it's not like the young men who go through it all of a sudden are like, oh yeah, I get all this. It's not like they don't go through stages the same way that I'm suggesting we do. But the club is a way of speeding up some of the stages, probably. And first of all, though, it's men assuming responsibility for the process of engaging men in advancing gender equity. This is something men need to take responsibility for. I think it helps to reduce the anger and denial stage, shorten it. I think it allows young men to move more quickly into acceptance stages, and more quickly into private and public action stages. And it's also creating a national network of men that devoted to gender equity and equality, who understand issues around gender equity and equality. Doesn't mean that they don't need to learn a lot more, but they've bought into the issue in various ways. It's something that I wish I had had when I was their age. One of the reasons I continue to do this work is because I think of myself as helping to give young men something that I didn't have. And I want to end with a picture of Abby and I, men and women as allies. We're still together after 27 years, and I'm firmly convinced that if we hadn't worked through some of these gender issues, that we would not be together. We certainly wouldn't be together in the same kind of way. Our relationship is better than it's ever been, and I think it'll continue to be that way. So happy that I came across Men Can Stop Rape, and I've had the opportunity to take advantage of this, and that we have the opportunity to help young men understand what it means to be invested in gender equity and gender equality and men and women as allies. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.